as Titus's right to do so according to Mithrin law. Fortunately for the safety of our citizens, it was not his right according to United States law. When the request for the duel to be held on U.S. territory and land was refused by a myriad of government institutions, the Mithrins shut the door to all of us. Now Pellissier is no longer answering our calls. In fact, not one single vampire in the entire United States is returning our calls. I knew all this. The number of U.S. legalities involved had been too long to deal with, from duels being illegal in most U.S. states, to ICE and the federal government working to ensure that these particular European vampires were never allowed on U.S. soil, even for a visit. As Leo's enforcer, a position of power in vamp hierarchy, and as the Dark Queen, a title I was still learning about, I knew most everything going on, and I could tell Sol none of it. I said, "Tell me that doesn't surprise you. The government flipped off paras and then expected the para leaders to keep in contact with them. You're a para. You know better." Sol sighed over the connection. "We've asked the Robert twins and George Dumas to liaise with us on this matter, and they refused. We've brought in the governor's office, several maritime organizations, including the Coast Guard, and half a dozen other agencies. Rick LaFleur is traveling internationally more than he's here, so he's little help. But Pellissier won't talk to anyone now." One of the Roberts was a lawyer. George, a.k.a. Bruiser, my boyfriend, had been Leo's primo at one time and still had a lot of pull with the MOC. And all three were Honorios, which we needed at the fight with the Europeans. They were the judges and the keepers of the peace. Did the government know that last part? Sure. Why not? This thing had been foobarred from the beginning. And Rick, I hadn't known that my ex was traveling. That was interesting, too, if not pertinent to this convo. Leo had pulled in his nets and gone back to port, as the fishing metaphor went. He had walked away from the government, a government that refused to recognize his species as equal to humans in protections under the law. So now the government and law enforcement were at my door, claiming a personal relationship to get my help. Ducky. The coffin door in my heart slammed shut. Sol went on. "Titus and Leo have since requested permission to broadcast the battles, though no traditional broadcast networks have picked up on it. However, no one can stop the broadcast via internet, pay-per-view, despite the violence, and a number of providers are bidding on the rights with Leo. George and the Roberts are also involved in these high-level talks, and they are not calling us back. And you can't make them, because the government in general refused to work with the suckheads and their humans." Yeah, Sol knew a lot more than I expected. I nodded to my partner and he said, "Okay, still listening." "I just discovered that the Europeans are planning to hold offshore gambling on the matches and have agreed that the tax income from the bets won and lost will go to Louisiana if the state will partner with them." My eyebrows went up. That was a surprise. "This is likely to result in a great deal of money," Sol said over the cell connection. "And it seems that someone high up in the Louisiana state government is suddenly interested, which means we are scrambling. It's all tangled up in federal and state law, with everyone wanting a piece of the action or to be seen as politically strong, fighting to keep more bloodsuckers out of the U.S. "Right," I said, headaches spiking again, feeling tired in every bone of my body. "Everyone's scrambling for power. My personal concern is that if Leo leaves Louisiana and goes into international waters, aboard a European ship to fight, who will be in control of his lands while he is away?" Sol asked. "Who will inherit if he loses? What will happen to the humans and the political balance we have established so far? It's precarious, especially with new laws being proposed in Congress for paranormal citizenship. I want someone with Leo to handle all of that, and Iotis has the experience, the charm, and the diplomatic know-how. but not if he lost control and tried to kill one of you. He says he's related to Jane, Elas said. I see. Sol paused, perhaps in thought. I've been unable to confirm or deny this in any official records. The records of Jane Yellowrock began the day she walked out of the mountains at a supposed age 12. She hesitated, and then went on again, as if feeling her way through what she wanted to say. Aya's records appear when he supposedly entered an orphanage at age 4 and ended when he ran away at age 14. He reappeared at a supposed age 20, having changed his name, and acquired an education by taking classes in 3 different universities, 2 online, graduating with a degree in criminal justice. There are photos of him at only one of those schools, she added, telling us that his history might have been faked. And in one photo we have of him at the orphanage, his ears appear to be shaped differently. Children's faces altered drastically as they grew, but the shape and placement of ears never changed, except by surgery. Ears were as individual as fingerprints. What Sol was describing stated that Iadis had assumed the identity of a dead child, a runaway from the orphanage. It was typical of the way long-lived paranormals maintained a legal position in the world. Iadis was likely older than his papers claimed. I had guessed that all skinwalkers were long-lived, that my father died only because the white man had shot and killed him before he could shift and heal, and that all skinwalkers were yellow-eyed like me. All assumptions, but with some small amount of evidence to support them. Iadis could be far older than he looked. As to whether he is related, she said, no one has done a genetic comparison to determine a relationship. Some creatures recognize one another's familial scent. That didn't happen. He smelled like Skinwalker, not like me. No, though Beast thought so. And genetic comparisons wouldn't work anyway. I'd seen my DNA. It was a mess. So he's here. He's both lying and legit. He has a job to do, Elas said. His shooting at Jane appears to be a mistake. Pretty big mistake for an officer of the law. Damn stupid, Elas said, letting ire into his voice. He should be put on administrative leave. An internal investigation should be begun. Yes. Sol laughed softly, almost sadly. Her laughter had always reminded me of bells and woodwinds, and it made me want to smile with her and hide my own braying laughter. Now it just made my head hurt worse. And when he tells an IA investigator that he drew on Jane because she smells like a dangerous, cannibalistic, paranormal creature, and Jane is once again put back at the top of the Psyled's person of interest list. Eli's eyes narrowed, and he looked at me to make sure I understood that we had just been blackmailed. Sol had us over a barrel. I will need to discuss this with Aya, though I would prefer to keep it out of his record, Sol added. Aya, I thought. She called him by a nickname. Sol liked him. We won't be making any reports, Eli said, but I could hear his unwillingness to let the attack go. Leo will not speak to any law enforcement agency or special agent. I would consider it a personal favor, she said, if you would introduce Iadis to Leo and smooth the way for negotiations.
Copy all that. And we'll consider it a personal favor if Iadis keeps his weapons in his pants,
Eli said.
We'll be calling if he kills someone, and Psyled can clean up the mess.
Eli tapped off the cell and drew his weapon, looked at me.
I can send the request to Leo's secretary,
Alex said, glancing at me beneath his long curls. When I tilted my head a fraction of an inch in agreement, he added,
If anyone can get Leo to see a cop, it's Scrappy. That's what's called the fine art of delegation.
He tapped on his official cell. Edmund, I asked without raising my voice, hiding the gel pack under a decorative pillow. You can let him out. The shelving opened fully,
revealing the small stone-lined room beneath the stairs, the revolving weapon safe in the corner, the foot of the small bed, and Iotis. He stumbled out, obviously having been pushed. The shelving door closed on the daylight, protecting my master vamp primo from the sun. Iotis looked a little the worse for wear. His long black hair snarled, his clothes rumpled, but no smell of blood on the air. No vamp blood and no skinwalker blood, which meant that the man calling himself my brother had managed to avoid getting rolled, hadn't allowed himself to be sipped from, and Edmund hadn't forced him to drink vamp blood, a trait I liked in my primo. Things had gotten a little physical, but there had been no forcing a blood bond. Forcing a bond was horrible. I knew that from my own personal encounter. I still had problems dealing with, well, lots of things, because of that experience.
You people are insane,
Iotis spat out. He sounded remarkably like a cat, and Beast peered through my eyes. I could tell she was captivated by the man, and I wondered if my eyes were glowing gold. It happened. Why? I asked. We didn't kill you. The vampire didn't drink you down even though you shot at his master and we woke him from his beauty sleep. And we're providing you a room to clean up in. We've been really nice hosts. Except for the whole squishing his balls and keeping him cuffed and tossing him into a lair with a sleepy vamp. Reporting him to his upline boss and mentor. Yeah, there was all of that. Eli tossed him his cell phone and Iotis caught it in midair without a bobble.
Call Sol, Eli said. Then go clean up. The rest of your belongings are in the guest bedroom upstairs, front left corner. Clean sheets. Towels on the foot of the bed. Late lunch in 20.
It's Eli's white chicken breast Cajun salad made with capers and dill,
Alex said, without looking up from his tablets, laptops, and personal desktop computer, and Wi-Fi cloud system with all the latest bells and whistles. Desktops like this had to be hand-built, and the components had cost us over $5,000. But it allowed us to act as a hub for every computer system, security system, cell phone, tablet, and GPS tracking system owned by Leo's people. Alex was bent over it, tapping away.
And if I don't like dill?
Iotis asked, shaking his hair back and wiping his face with his shirt sleeve.
Starve.
Alex said, again without looking up. I smiled slightly, thinking, that's my bro. Iotis Firewind disappeared up the stairs, his fancy shoes silent on the wood treads. Either he had special soles, or he moved like a cat, or a hunting Cherokee warrior. I was going for doors number 2 and 3. I closed my eyes and dropped my head back again, pulling the gel pack from beneath the pillow and laying it in place, eyes closed.
Still happy you didn't buy that bigger place?
Eli asked, a little knowing spite in his tone. He had found a traditional Creole townhome only a few miles away that was roughly 3 times the size of this house. But this was home, or as close as I'd ever gotten. Not that I'd told him that. I just said the larger house was too expensive, and it had been, still was. Very, but we have to stop taking in strays, I said. Eli and Alex both snorted. Alex said,
We have almost everything integrated, and Bodat will be in town later today to help me finish up.
That was good news, and bad news. With the new system, we knew where everyone of Leo's people were at all times, who they were chatting with, and what burner devices they were using to try to keep their activities secret from the MOC. The kid, Alex, had devised several algorithms to keep the information from being too overwhelming, but even so, it was not a one-man job. If Yellow Rock Securities was going to survive the Sangre Duello and stay in NOLA, we needed serious, geekish help. We were going to have to outsource or hire someone in-house. Either would change the dynamics of our lives. Again. So, Bodat was the best choice. Even if it meant we had to find him a place to stay temporarily.
No way was he staying here long term. Just thinking about the garlic-smelling, doughy-fleshed teen was enough to give me the shivers and make my headache feel worse. Bodat was one of Alex's World of Warcraft buddies, who had helped us with a case in Natchez. He was a couple of years younger than Alex and lived in Mississippi. The pasty-skinned kid was planning to attend Tulane in the fall, which was where Alex was going for his doctorate, now that he was finished with probation. Bodat was a hacker wannabe and had a knack for scanning and compiling data. He was working hard to learn the back doors of computer hacking and also had a serious case of hero worship for Alex, which he tried hard to keep hidden. It was cute. But Bodat. I sighed softly. Alex and Eli put a blanket over me and went into the kitchen to prepare a late lunch.
"Why do you think Janie is your sister?"
Alex asked.
Iotis halted, spoon halfway to his mouth.
It was filled with vanilla ice cream and blueberry mango cobbler fresh out of the oven. Lunch had been carefully polite, with no mention of relationships or how Sol might have reacted to Iotis shooting at me. Mostly the meal had been guy chatter about the weather, the difference between an Arizona winter and a Louisiana one, and sports teams. Until now. He placed the spoon back in the bowl and looked from one to the other of us, as if trying to figure us out.
"According to her history, Jane appeared from the woods. My sister disappeared in a snowstorm. Many years passed. We are long-lived. Her body was never recovered. Why would Jane not have a long-lost brother?"
"Because she's a lot older than she looks. Alex?" This was not a topic of conversation I'd expected to be having. This was my most personal information, and Alex was on the verge of giving it all away. I put down my spoon, again sick at my stomach. Though the food and maybe the OTCs had helped my headache some, the pain wasn't gone, and nausea was one of the symptoms I suffered with a migraine-like agony. Alex didn't look at me.
"I mean, dude, she looks maybe 25, but she's old. She could be 30.
I wanted to laugh. He sounded like a typical teen. Though he was 20 now himself and growing up, mostly. And he was, not so suddenly, pumping Iotis.
"If we are siblings," Iotis said, picking up his spoon again without looking my way, "then Jane is much older than 25.
The words hung on the air for a dozen heartbeats. The odd emotions welled up in me again, a vortex of feelings that swirled together. Things like, I'm not alone. The people still exist. They came for me. Finally. 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 Mixed with the hope and the fear and the unanticipated possibilities was a wash of anger and suspicion. Why now? Why did you wait so long, only to use me? Is the skinwalker, the one who taught me to kill my first man and who pushed me into the snow to live or die, still alive? Is my mother still alive? I had posited that the skinwalker gene was X-linked, like the witches, passing on the mother's X chromosome. I'd assumed that I'd gotten the gene from my father, passed down from his mother, but for Iotis to be a skinwalker, and my full-blooded brother, my mother had to be a skinwalker too, since any brother would have gotten his only X chromosome from her. I shoved down on all the emotions, useless passions that were obscuring the rational, reasonable parts of me, the parts that might let me find my way through the maelstrom. It was unlikely that any of my family were alive. A demon called Kylona Ailiski claimed to have sucked the blood of a woman I remembered only as Unilisi, a term of respect, meaning grandmother of many children, and possibly actually my own grandmother, or great-grandmother. The demon had been one of the Sunayi Edahi, the invisible night-goers in Cherokee tradition. The demon claimed to have killed the grandmother who had taught me to kill. I had believed that the woman I remembered as grandmother was dead. but demons weren't known for telling the truth.
Like, how much older? Alex asked. Jane's a woman. Women don't like to talk about their ages.
I might have laughed or rolled my eyes, but this was deadly serious, vitally important, and my headache was still pretty bad. Eye-rolling was out.
I'm telling you my history. My deepest, most personal story.
He looked at me now, his golden eyes intense beneath hawk-wing brows. He pushed away the fruit cobbler and bent his elbows on the table, his fingers interlaced. Long fingers, very slender, familiar. I clenched my fists together beneath the table. I didn't know the Psy-led cop who claimed kinship, but he seemed quiet, wary, contained, as if holding down emotional reactions until he could deal with them later, privately. Almost shooting me, a future confrontation with his boss about that attempted shooting, had to be weighing heavily on him. Yet there was nothing of that in his demeanor.
I'm telling you this, because I hope you are my sister, and there is no way to prove or disprove that hope unless I share everything with you. Things I have not discussed with anyone in decades.
I nodded, that peculiar Tsalagi chin jut of affirmation.
I was born on the Nuna Daul Tsuni, the Trail of Tears.
No one was eating. No one was even breathing.
My mother told me that my 5-year-old sister had been killed by soldiers after she attacked one of them with a knife. It was the lie they told the soldiers to keep them from searching for her. I learned later that my sister had attacked a man who raped a Cherokee woman and grievously wounded him. The leader of our clan had forced my skinwalker sister into the form of a bobcat and drove her into the snow to save her from the soldiers.
He knew too much. He knew things I didn't, or claimed things. But it fit. It all fit. Who is the leader of your clan? I asked, my words as soft as a speaker of the people.
She goes by the name Hayalatsi, six-man killer.
It was an interesting choice of names he fed me. Hayalatsi was one of the Cherokee names for knife. If Hayalatsi was the woman I knew so long ago, then I had been present for the deaths of 2 of the 6 men she killed.
I just called her Unilisi,
he added and smiled.
She scared me to death when I was a child.
He pulled a cell phone from his pocket and placed it on the table between us.
Call her. She is still alive. She and a small group of her family and clan moved back to the Appalachian Mountains about 70 years ago.
Still alive. Small group of her family and clan. I smiled, a twitch of my lips. I took a breath that moved air over my tongue, through my nose, filled my parched lungs. He scented of the truth. Yet though everything this man said could be truth, and would fulfill the deepest unrecognized longings of my heart, nothing, absolutely nothing, could be proven. What he thought was truth could be lies he believed. Our mother, human or skinwalker. His face fell into a vision of dour grief, old but potent.
Our mother was skinwalker born, though she lacked the ability to shift, and therefore aged as a human. She died while I was in the West. She was 75 years old, in good health. But one morning she simply did not wake.
He seemed about to say more, but fell silent. I looked at Eli and Alex, who were watching me. Kindness on their faces. Kindness that made tears prick my lids. I pushed away from the table without touching the cell. Eat your cobbler. Leo will be up at dusk. Alex has sent an official request to bring a visitor. For now, I'm getting some sleep. Looking at Eli, I communicated a lot of things in one glance before going to my room, where I stripped and fell onto my bed. I didn't expect to sleep, but I did. Dreams like a vortex of head pain and possibilities, and half-recalled bloody memories. My hand holding the cross-hatched hilt of a knife. Bloody. Blood everywhere. just like my entire life. I laid out the slim black pants, black jacket, and white silk men's-style dress shirt on the bed, added a silk scarf and black dancing shoes. The straps over the instep gave me excellent balance in case of unexpected attack, and the heels gave me an extra 3 inches over my 6 feet in height. With my weapons, I'd look lean, mean, and scary. It was what Madame Melisande, Modiste de la Mithrons, my business and formal clothes designer, called dangerous business dressy, meaning it had slits, fake pockets, and loops for weapons. I took a fast shower, pulled my hair up, and braided it into a fighting queue, so tight it made my head ache, but in a different way from the headache before my nap. I stuck silver and ashwood stakes into the braided top knot bun like a deadly crown. Satisfied that the hair was less of a weapon than it otherwise could be, I started dressing. I strapped on a sleek harness around my waist, slightly to the right. Inserted a tiny Walther PK-380 handgun into the soft leather holster. Kydex was nice, but not if I had to sit with the weapon cutting into me. The small gun would be easily available to me through the right pocket slit in my pants, and with a shirt that belled out around me slightly, and the scarf hanging to my hips, no one would ever know the gun was there. Scarves were dangerous in a fight, and I didn't wear them, but this one had caught my eye, gold and silver and copper silk. Onto the same waist harness, I strapped 2 blade sheaths and secured them to my upper thighs for right and or left hand extraction. Into the sheaths, I secured short-bladed silver-plated vamp killers with 6-inch blades. I pulled on and adjusted a brand new tactical sports bra with built-in dual underarm holsters for the matching HK-45s. I adjusted the cant of each weapon and made sure there were no rounds in the chambers, even at the expense of the time I'd use to ready the weapons in the event of a firefight. I might not start a small war, but I could finish one, unless I shot myself in the boob. That had to hurt. So, safety first. I pulled on the outer clothes and slid bare feet into my dancing shoes, securing the clasps. I looked like a businesswoman. No weapons visible. The men's shirt appeared to have buttons, but was closed with hidden snaps that I could rip through in a heartbeat to get the H&Ks. Sometimes speed of draw is less of a factor than appearing to be unarmed. However, my face still looked crappy. I put on makeup, that thick, pasty stuff that makes sleepless and pained under-eye bruises less noticeable. Then powder, blush, and mascara. A dab of gold shadow at the corners of my eyes. I still wasn't good at putting on makeup, but I had learned a little. On the outside of my clothes, I strapped on the Moogle blade my sweet cheeks had given me. It was ancient, curved Damascene steel, fancy and decorative and sharp as death. And its scarlet velvet-covered wooden sheath would draw attention from any bulges or other evidence of the real weapons. I wrapped the pretty scarf around my neck and adjusted the ends for more concealment. Rethought the scarf, which could be used as a handle to yank me around. Re-rethought it. Left it. And I was still wasting time. I looked at the stack of protocol books on the table. There was one for each species, one for each social situation, one for dancing, and 4 that detailed different kinds of introductions. While the Sangre Duello used little that was contained in them, I knew I should use the exact wording and proper protocol to introduce Iotis to Leo. But, nah. Crass was almost always better. I dialed the Mithrin Council chambers and got scrappy. Lee Williams Watts, Mr. Pellissier's personal assistant. How may I help you? Oh, sorry, Jane. I didn't look at the screen. What's up? Hey, Scrappy. How's the boss? Pretty good, though I have to say that taking dictation in his bathroom is new. I breathed out a laugh. His bathroom. He and Katie and Alicia Fontenot were all in the tub together making up and making out. Lots of bloody bubbles, thank God. Oh. I couldn't think of anything else to say. Picking up my jacket with a finger in the collar loop, I opened my bedroom door and entered the house proper. I dropped a shoulder against the wide cased opening into the living room, talking, listening, smelling, and watching. There were four men and a pudgy kid in the room, and three of the group looked distinctly uncomfortable, as if I'd walked into the middle of something that was about to be unpleasant. Eli was scowling, a partially unsheathed blade in one hand. Bruiser was standing angled to the other two as if he might be about to launch into some martial art move. Iotis's face wore an expression I'd call cop face, ready for anything. Clearly someone had done something to someone else and things had escalated. I frowned at them, my expression saying, "Really? Now?" Beast leaped to the forefront of my mind, peering out at the tableau. Littermates have steel claws. Littermates play battle. Beast wants to play. But Lee was still talking. Right. There was lots of giggling, and the presence of the bloody bubbles tells me they were having a good time. Way too good a time for a lowly human like me to want to be there for long. Alicia and Katie Fontenot were sisters, and Katie had been, until very recently, Leo's heir, while Alicia had been his madam spy and a traitor. Last I heard, they were both in the Scion prison together, locked up for betraying Leo. Things in the vamp world changed at a glacial rate, one they called the long view, until they changed fast. Then helped the poor human or skinwalker who couldn't keep up. As a joke, Alex had emailed me a flowchart. I'd kept it and used it. "I don't blame you," I said. "Anyway, what can I do for you?" Scrappy asked. "Alex send you a message?" Scrappy said, "A personal message, yes." That said a world of important things in vamp hierarchy. "A non-human Psyled agent named Iotis Firewind wishes to parlay with Leo. The enforcer would like you to arrange a casual little tea with him. Gregoire, Katie, Bruiser, and my people. Tonight, early." After a silence that lasted a beat too long, Lee said, "Enforcer," using my title, making it formal. "We have an opening between 7:30 and 8. "Got it," I said. "Interesting mix of guests, especially since Mr. Pellissier turned down a meeting with Psyled multiple times this week." She was fishing for info. I let a small smile cross my face. "I think so, too." Scrappy said, "Okay, then. Do you need a car sent for you or your guest?" "No. He'll be riding over with us. However, he'll need a place to stay. Would you make an arrangement with the Hotel Mont Lyon? One of the executive suites would do. Put it on Leo's tab." "Consider it done. If that's all, I'll see the enforcer and her guests in a bit." "Thank you, Lee." She hesitated at the use of her proper name and then said, "Thank you, enforcer." Enforcer, not Jane, making sure we were still not personal when doing vamp business. "Got it." She ended the call and I tucked the cell into my jacket pocket, slung it over my shoulder and slouched some more, one hand in a faux pocket that was really a weapon slit. The men were still in pre-combat positions, ready to fight. Stupid men. Beast wants to play with stupid men. "I don't see any blood yet," I said. "Didn't hear any shots fired. You want to tell me why my boyfriend, one of my partners, and my uninvited house guests are looking like you're about to rumble?"
"A misunderstanding," Iotis said.
"No misunderstanding."
In his best, most ticked-off British accent, Bruiser said,
"One week ago, Special Agent Iotis Firewind called me for an introduction to Leo. I refused. Now he's in your home, claiming to be your long-lost baby brother. And he bloody well has not only an introduction but a casual little tea. That is, if I heard correctly the conversation that just ended."
"Hmm," I said. "Yeah, he says he's my brother." Bruiser shot me a look.
"Firewind didn't mention that he might be related to you."
He looked back at Iotis.
"However, yellow eyes and golden copper skin are not a common combination.
There is a familial resemblance.
Bruiser eased back a step, relaxing from attack mode into something more like high alert. My honey bunch was wearing black tonight. Black suit, black silk shirt, no tie. His hair slicked back with something that held it in place and also made it look darker. He looked scrumptious, especially with all his feathers ruffled in a protect-the-little-woman attitude. Instincts left over from his upbringing in England back a century or so ago. It was a cute instinct, but unnecessary. Eli was in black, too, but black jeans and a t-shirt with a jacket. He fully sheathed his blade but left his battle face on. That left my supposed brother, who had pulled a weapon once today, and currently one hand was positioned to go for his service weapon. All very odd for a cop, with their prescribed grounds for anything involving a weapon. His expression was tight and cold, body bladed to the others, knees slightly bent in defensive position against multiple possible attackers. This man had seen combat, no doubt about it. Maybe not this century, but recently enough for the reflexes to still be honed. I said, "If you draw a weapon in my house again, you better be using it to save my people. Otherwise, I'll be shoving it up your ass and emptying the chamber." She said, "Ass," the pasty-skinned kid said to Alex. "I thought Jane didn't cuss." "Ass isn't cussing, Bodat. Sit down," Alex said, yanking his friend from behind the couch where he had been half-hiding. A few seconds too many passed before Iotis dropped his hand and relaxed. "Any reason why you didn't tell George Dumas that you're my brother?" I asked Iotis.
"I had planned that private, intimate moment with you," he said, sounding grumpy.
It was a tone I had heard from my mouth often enough that it rang with familiarity.
"None of my plans or actions have gone well since I got to New Orleans."
"You got into my home without getting killed first, told me a lovely story about your past and mine with just enough details to not get you shot. Yet. And you got a meeting with Leo out of the deal. What's gone wrong?" There must have been something sensible in my tone, because both Eli and Bruiser slid gazes to me and to each other. Iotis's expression shifted into wary neutral. "Progress." "You're wily as a laqua," I said, "but without the rattles to tell me you're about to strike. I find nothing to like about you." I saw the skin beside Eli's eye relax, not something anyone else would have noticed. He was relieved that I hadn't been blinded by hope and desire for a past to the man's serious flaws. Iotis, on the other hand, gave away nothing I could interpret. His black brows drew down slightly. That was it. Could have meant anything. I continued. "Except for your height, hair, and nose, we have nothing in common." And his fingers, his jaw, his attitude. All familiar. Not saying that. "Too much planning here. Things that look like coincidence but aren't." I decided to jab and see how he took it. "I'm not sure if you have any honor at all." Iotis's back stiffened, just the tiniest bit, and some small, sadistic part of me found pleasure in the insult I had delivered and his reaction.
"A woman who sleeps with the master of the city has honor."
I laughed. He could hit below the belt, too. Maybe it was a family trait. "I thought you had done your research. As a favor to Sol, I'll introduce you to Leo. You're on your own after that." I glanced at the long doors on the side wall. It was dusk, but my primo's shelving unit was still shut. On purpose. Punishment for making him try to roll Iotis. I deserved it. I was scum. In for a penny, in for a pounding. To Bruiser and Eli, I said, "Cuff him, and throw him in the back of the SUV." Chapter 3. My life was a soap opera with fangs and fur. Iotis didn't resist, and when he was deposited on the parking area of the drive at Vamp Central, with his cell, his badge, and his weapon,
he managed to still look like a fashion plate. He was wearing a suit, black, but with shimmering midnight blue tints when the light hit the fabric just right. His shirt matched the blue tints, and his tie was a glistening black that perfectly matched his long black hair. Leo would get one whiff of him and want the man in his bed. As Eli removed the agent's cuffs, Bruiser leaned to me and murmured, "You're wearing the blade I gave you, love. You look beautiful and deadly." This man knew just what to say. I leaned my temple against his, watching my partner, but stealing a quiet moment. With the shoes, I was right at Bruiser's height, and his skin was heated, a peaceful warmth. His Onorio scent filled my nostrils, and I blew out the breath, more calm than I had been since my brother tried to kill me. No, not my brother. Not proven yet. Firewind. Since Firewind tried to kill me. But the thought let me know just how much I wanted it to be true. Him, his stories. A past I might learn of and might remember someday. Questions he might answer about who and what I was. "You look amazing, too," I said. "Can we just skip all this and go to your place?" Bruiser chuckled and encircled my waist, pulling me closer. He had to feel the other weapons against his body, but he said nothing about them. We had come a long way since the time he kissed me on a limo floor and found a weapon strapped to my thigh. "Be safe, my love," he said. "Be wise." "Ditto to you." I stood straight as he kissed me on the temple, and I stepped out of his embrace to climb the steps after Eli and our prisoner guest. As enforcer, I had a defined place among my people, but no way was I letting Iotis Firewind behind me. We went through the front door, between the metal detectors, and directly into the bullet-resistant glass cage. The others started to remove weapons as part of the security measures, but I leaned into the mic on the wall and said, "Operation Wise Guy by orders of the enforcer." Rassler appeared at the front of the inner doors as they whooshed open, blowing in the scent of vamps and sex and something tasty like roast venison. Derek Lee stepped out from the area near the elevator. Both men wore charcoal suits and dove gray shirts with slightly darker, dovish ties. The grays were Clan Policier colors, the livery of the clan for hundreds of years. It was disconcerting to see them in the clothing. Though the special order thin, cut-resistant Kevlar Dyneema-based body armor vests they wore beneath their clothes made me happy. I glanced around to see all the security types in similar suits and shirts, armored vests peeking out beneath. Derek stopped several feet back and waited, hands at his sides, less than inches from his weapons.
"Enforcer,"
Rassler said. I glanced at Iotis and caught him sniffing the air, nostrils widening and contracting. Yeah, HQ was a full olfactory onslaught. I led the way out into the foyer. "Senior Special Agent Iotis Firewind of Psyled, to see the Master of the City of New Orleans and the Greater Southeast United States. We have been scheduled in for tea, though we're early. We can wait in the green room." The green room was a decorative little sitting room with couches and a kitchenette with snacks, colas, coffee, and a variety of teas. It was also a room that could be secured from outside.
"His weapon?" Derek asked. "Empty of ammo,"
Eli said. Iotis gave a micro flinch and I smiled. The skilled Psyled agent hadn't noticed the weight difference. He might look all smooth and calm and sophisticated, but his emotions had overwhelmed his instincts and training. It might be silly, but that made me like him a little.
"Mr. Policier is running a bit late,"
Rassler said.
"May I suggest a visit to the gym? He's integrating the Mithrins visiting from Canada. Our guest might find it instructional."
At my side, Bruiser shifted slightly, not happy with current events, especially the word instructional. Rassler was a seriously big guy. His nickname derived from the World Wrestling Federation, for which he could have auditioned to become a star if he hadn't sworn loyalty to Leo. But instructional, I thought. Instructional for whom? Inside me, Beast chuffed. I was not going to ruin these clothes just to put on a show for Leo's guests. A sparring match would ruin my outfit. I liked these clothes. They were girly enough to be, well, not guy clothes, and they hid the weapons. I glared at Rassler. He looked back at me with complete equanimity, even as he passed out the mini earbuds and mics that would tie us to the comm system. Iotis didn't get one. When I didn't answer, Bruiser answered for all of us, saying, "The Enforcer, her second, the Honorio, and Special Agent Firewind would be happy to observe the activities in the gym." "I'll sit it out," Eli said. He tilted his head to the new security room off the entrance. Derek met my eyes, his questioning, asking if my guest was a danger to Leo. I shrugged slightly. Derek was Leo's part-time enforcer and my immediate subordinate. We both knew my position was short-term, finished with the Sangre Duello, and I was done with the vamps. But Derek wanted long-term employment, and the blood Leo was feeding his mom to keep her alive. Even part-time enforcer was way above acting as guide and bodyguard. Yet he said, "If you'll follow me." He touched his earbud and led the way to the elevator. I put on my mini headset and followed at the back of the pack, ignoring the inscrutable look Iotis sent my way. Tribal people did inscrutable well. I wanted to stick my tongue out at him, but I sent him a matching look instead. We opened the door to a roar of voices and the clack, clack, clack of multiple wood staves. I took it in with a glance. All of the fighting rings were in use. There were five now, since the new mats had been delivered and installed. In the back of the room, Leo was sparring with Ro Moore, Katie's enforcer. Katie was sparring with her sister, and in the ring closest to me, G. D. Messi, my enforcer, which still felt weird on my tongue and in my mind, was sparring with a tribal woman, a Canadian vamp. The woman G fought was as tall as I was, but with much stronger bone structure and enviable shoulders, with long hair the color of the night sky. Amusement and interest sparked in her black eyes. Her name was Namida, which meant star dancer in Ojibwe, and my enforcer had been enamored of her since the first time he laid eyes on the vamp in Canada. Judging from the smell of blood and pain on the air, the Canadians were learning how New Orleans vamps fought. In a word, dirty. Xi was gifted a personal glamour, and because Namida was so tall, he had made his human-shaped body taller and leaner, and his face more traditionally Anishinaabe than his usual Spanish. Two other Canadian vamps were fighting with local vamps. They were good, their technique different from the La Destreza taught in Nola. All the fighting pairs were using sticks instead of long swords, one in each hand, bruising hardwood, bone-breaking hardwood. Some sparred with two long sticks, some with one long and one shorter. The longer staves had the length and balance and heft of flat swords. The shorter staves were styled to match the caja corta, loosely translated as short box or short trap. Both kinds were made for killing Mithrins, and Namida was landing taps on G. My enforcer was one of the best fighters in Nola, and Namida was laying a hurtin' on him. She was fast, even for a vamp, but then G might be executing some deceptive courting, letting her beat him up as foreplay. I stepped inside and out of the doorway, beneath the camera over my head. The others lined up next to me, and the door closed. The gym was old-fashioned, with ancient wood floors patched in a few places since I joined Leo's team. Beast's claws were hard on floors. There were cameras everywhere, covering the entire room with its full basketball court, newly painted shuffleboard court, and the padded circular fighting mats.
She danced out of the way and I caught a glimpse of Ro in the back, completing a move I hadn't seen her use before. She swept across at Leo's collarbone with her right stick, a decapitation move, and then shoved Leo with the end of the left stick. Had she been wielding swords, she would have taken off his head and pierced his heart, two fatal moves against a vamp at once. As it was, Leo was shoved out of the ring and onto the wood. He laughed. It was a pleased sound, silken, joyful, captivating. I glanced at Iotis to see him narrow his eyes at the sensation of the laughter dancing along his skin. I couldn't be mesmerized, but I didn't know if it was a skinwalker thing or a beast thing. Iotis didn't roll over and pant for attention, but he did seem a little rattled. Leo's laughter made his people happy, ready to follow him to the ends of the earth. Ro Moore joined in the laughter and Leo said, "You are faster than I expected. The sharing of blood was well worth your healing. I am pleased." Ro clacked her staves together, crossing them without looking away from Leo. He wasn't above cheating. This time he clacked his sticks together and held out a hand for Ro's staves before turning to the doorway. "My enforcer," he called. "Ye bring us a guest." I gave him a small nod. Leo was wearing fighting clothes, fashioned with a twist all his own. He was shirtless, to show the pure white of his scars, scars from wounds that no human could have survived, and not many vamps. Nudity in the fighting rings was uncommon among the Europeans, and there had been a lot of chatter about Leo going naked for the entire Sangre Duelo proceedings, just to shake them up. Sadly, that had sort of been my idea, when I suggested they play Petruchio and Kate in Taming of the Shrew to shake up the Eurovamps. I hadn't meant naked. I really hadn't meant naked. There was also chatter about Leo leaving blood on his body after feedings and fights, and acting the crude, naive thug to throw off Titus's fine-tuned sensibilities. It would make a good show. But Leo was fastidious. No way was he going to be messy, bloody, or dirty, or display unsophisticated or bad manners for any length of time. I was pretty sure Derek had a pool going for how long Leo would last unshowered. The Sangre Duelo was a more violent, less systematic version of Le Duel Sang, the codified legal duels that decided a vamp's place in clan and city. While it started out polite, Sangre Duelo had no matches where the winner moved up in a predetermined order. The Duelo meant death at the end as challengers dueled and killed opponents until the only vamps left were the most protected, the very best fighters, and the MOCs. First blood in the battles was meant to maim, and duels to the death were expected. There was no way to think of the contests as games. They required mental stamina, clear thinking, excellent understanding of tactics and strategy, physical endurance and skill, and in the end, the willingness to kill. When the European emperor's servants came ashore, onto Leo's territory, and attacked by means both magical and weapons-based, Leo's U.S. vampire scions and human servants started dying in greater numbers, and Leo could see his power base slipping away. To keep his people alive and safe, the MOC felt he had no choice but to demand Sangre Duelo. But if Leo lost, his loyal people lost and would likely be killed outright, as would all his blood servants, blood slaves, cattle, and every other para as Titus and his victorious fang heads rolled over New Orleans and took over the United States. Hence Leo's consideration of most anything to throw off the EV Emperor's plans and reasoning. Eli had suggested getting together with some former Navy SEALs and swimming out to the Emperor's boat with enough explosives to sink them to the bottom of the Gulf, but there were likely prisoners on the boat. Leo had nixed that idea, but it was still floating around the security taps as a last-ditch strategy. And likely it was something the U.S. military was keeping on a back burner as a black ops possibility should Titus win. Leo popped in front of us, moving with vamp speed and the distinctive sound of displaced air. His black hair had come loose from its fighting cue at the back of his neck, and the old scars on his torso were bone white against his vamp pale skin. His fangs were out. His still human eyes were on Iotis.
"My guest for tea this evening," he said around his fangs. "My sworn ally, Roseanne Romanello, from Sedona, has hinted that you are quite the warrior."
He extended Ro Moore's staves.
"Shall we?"
It was more a demand than an invitation. I turned to Iotis. He had visited the master of the city of Sedona. I knew Roseanne. I had probably helped to save her life. She knew what I was, and would have had no reason to keep any secrets from Iotis. I gave the special agent a toothy expression that couldn't really be called amusement. More like, gotcha. Holding his eyes, I said, "Have fun, Iotis. And Leo, watch out. He's sneaky as a snake.
The better to spar with."
Leo waggled the staves. His face showing nothing, Iotis slid out of his jacket, then his shoulder holster, and unclipped his badge, handing them to Derek. He pulled an elastic out of a pocket and pulled his hair back, tucking it into his shirt where the long strands couldn't blind him. The tail could still be used as a weapon, but it would take close contact to get a hand on it. Then he kicked off his dress shoes and peeled off his socks. Even his sweaty feet smelled floral as he accepted the staves and walked across the gym to the empty fighting mat. The fighting mats cleared out, and the number of spectators along the walls and sitting on the bleachers increased. Someone whispered,
"Prepararse para la muerte,"
which was Spanish for prepare for death. I said, softly but loud enough for Leo to hear, "This man is a special agent of Psy-Led and under the protection of the Enforcer. And he may be my brother. Or not. If Iotis somehow hurt Leo, I might be able to keep him alive long enough to get him outside." The men went through the meet-and-greet ceremony, a truncated version that skipped the names and titles and went straight to tapping staves together in a salute. Iotis moved in and tapped Leo's staves, then back out fast. Faster than human. Skinwalker fast. I knew that speed. Without Beast, it was my own speed. Pulling on Beast's abilities was like Skinwalker on turbo. Leo backed away and his stave started circling in La Destreza, the cage of death, the magic circle. So did Iotis's. Interesting. And interestinger. Iotis knew La Destreza. They engaged slowly as Leo tapped Iotis's staves, a two-tap with his long stick. Iotis tapped back with lunges, feeling out his opponent. His feet were long and slender at the heels, wide at the toes, the shape of the feet of a man who wore moccasins in his youth, not boots or shoes. Yet the skin of his feet was smooth, the feet of a man who got regular petties. Or who shifted shape to an animal and then back into the form of his human DNA, with no calluses or scars. His knees were bent for balance, his quads pushing against the suit pants. He was poised, posture neat, his body stable, rock steady. The taps sped up, becoming clacks, loud enough to echo on the bare walls. No one was taking bets on the winner. Not yet. Iotis landed three taps on Leo. The master of the city laughed and tossed his shoulder-length hair. I realized he had left it down to give Iotis an advantage. Leo's version of fighting honor. The clacks sped, and sped again. I found myself moving closer, watching every move. Beast crouched at the front of my mind, panting, chuffing when one of the men landed what would have been a bloody, deadly wound had they fought with steel. Leo's long stave caught in Iotis's hair, ripping out the elastic, sending the hair in a swanning arc, free. And then, with his hair flying, Iotis raised the short stave back over his shoulder and threw it, like a small axe, like a tomahawk.
Time seemed to slow down for me. Not the gray between of time bending, but the battle time slowing that allowed me to see everything happening. The muscles in Iotis's arm flexing and releasing.